From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Malcolm X. As Americans line up to see Spike Lee's new movie, we talk about the impact of Malcolm X on America with Gerald Early, the chair of the African and Afro-American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. Several years before Malcolm X's life became the subject of a film, it was the subject of an opera. X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, was performed at the New York City Opera in 1986. Now it's finally been released on CD. Our classical music critic, Lord Schwartz, will review the recording, and we'll talk with the composer, Anthony Davis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger pleaded innocent today to federal charges that he lied about the existence of his personal notes in the Iran-Contra affair. In brief remarks afterward, Weinberger accused the special prosecutor of political motivations in bringing the indictment. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Leaving the courthouse today, Weinberger said, "I have not lied, nor will I ever. I have become a pawn in a clearly political agenda, as is shown by the return of the indictment only days before the presidential election." But Prosecutor James Brosnahan denied any political motivation for the indictment. "This case has nothing to do with politics," said Brosnahan, "and everything to do with government." He noted that the judge in the case had established a strict schedule, and Brosnahan said that in order to comply with that schedule, the indictment had to be returned before November. The prosecutor added that he had sought a postponement until after the election, but that it had been blocked by Weinberger's lawyers. Weinberger is scheduled to go on trial January 5th. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Agriculture officials said today that Russia has been suspended from the U.S. food credit program for failing to make its payments on time. Agriculture Department spokesman Roger Runningen said that Russia was almost $11 million behind on a payment to the private banks that are financing Russian purchases of U.S. farm products. The private bank loans are 100% backed by the U.S. government. Runningen said that it's not unheard of for countries to fall behind in their payments and to be quickly reinstated once the payments were made up. According to a report released today, many poor people in the U.S. are paying more than half their incomes on housing because of the lack of affordable places to live. The report analyzed census data from 44 of the largest metropolitan areas in the country. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The report documents a severe housing crisis across the country, with three of every four poor renters paying more for a roof over their head than they can afford. Under federal standards, poor people should not pay more than 30% of their income toward housing, but nearly half are shelling out 50% or more. Barry Zegas of the Low Income Housing Information Service says more subsidized housing would bring relief.
Rental assistance is a very, very effective way of reaching the most important need these families confront, and would be an extremely effective way at helping to resolve the housing crisis.
But those subsidies cost money, and given the country's economic woes, Ziga says it's unclear what the incoming Clinton administration and the new Congress will be able to do. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Stock prices were sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 26 points to close at 3,248.7. Advances led declines by a margin of nearly 2 to 1. This is NPR. Two United Nations vehicles were fired on today in a remote region of northwest Cambodia. Three UN elections personnel were injured when unidentified gunmen attacked the vehicles. Sue Downey reports from Phnom Penh.
The vehicles, clearly marked with large UN letters, were carrying UN police and electoral officers, three of whom received gunshot wounds and were evacuated by helicopter to the northwest capital of Battambang, where they are reported to be in a stable condition, although at least one of the three was seriously injured. It's not clear who was responsible for the attack, which occurred about 50 kilometres northwest of the famous Angkor Wat temples in Siem Reap province, in an area where government and Khmer Rouge troops operate, as well as bandits. This appears to be the first time a UN vehicle has been deliberately attacked in Cambodia, although 20 UN aircraft have been shot at, some with serious consequences. For National Public Radio, this is Sue Downey in Phnom Penh.
Relief officials in Somalia say that they may have to withdraw from the country unless the United Nations provides them with better security. Interaction, an umbrella group of private relief agencies, said that the UN is allowing itself to be dictated to by clans and warlords who have no legitimate authority. The UN has authorized 3,500 troops to provide security for relief shipments, but the troops have not been deployed because the UN has not been able to negotiate agreements with the faction leaders. The call for protection came as a UN-chartered ship loaded with food was hit by an artillery shell as it approached the harbor at Mogadishu. The vessel turned back out to sea. Representative Bill Emerson, who just returned from Somalia, said that donor nations are providing plenty of food, but lawless groups are preventing it from reaching those in need. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Malcolm X had the strength, the will, and the vision to recreate himself. He grew up in a detention home, became a street hustler and drug dealer, then had an intellectual, political, and spiritual awakening in prison, which led him to become a Muslim and a black nationalist. His autobiography inspired millions of readers to find strength in their own identities. Now Malcolm X is being reinvented again in the new movie by Spike Lee. The movie is reminding many people of the important influence Malcolm X has had on their lives, and it's introducing a new generation to his story. My guest Gerald Early has a personal essay about Malcolm X in the December issue of Harper's. Early is the chair of the African and African American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis, and he's the editor of a forthcoming book on ethnicity and race in America. Early told me why, when he read the autobiography of Malcolm X, he felt it was the only book written expressly for him, a young black American male.
Oh, because it was very urban book. The only other book I remember reading as a child, as an adolescent that I identified with by a black writer that was autobiographical was Black Boy. But I wasn't able to. I totally identified with that because Richard Wright was from Mississippi. I had never set foot in the South. But Malcolm's life was a northern urban life. I mean, he spent most of his youth in Lansing and in Boston and then in New York. So I think that's one of the major reasons I identified with it, because it seems so much the story of a northern black male and. You know, I was a northern black. I'm a northern black male.
You were from Philadelphia.
From Philadelphia.
So, how did you discover the autobiography?
Well, my family is pretty politically active, and my sister, my oldest sister, was involved in the civil rights movement. And when that book first came out, I remember it being in our home, and so that's how I got around to eventually reading. I don't recall a time. During the time from that time that book was first published onward, that a copy, if not more than one copy, was not in my mother's home.
Which parts of Malcolm's life did you most relate to?
I would say I mostly related to the early years up until the time that he had the conversion to Islam. I was even able to relate to the conversion of Islam because the conversion was largely intellectual conversion. It was largely being attracted to adapting a whole bunch of new habits about yourself. In some ways, his conversion was sort of like what a young man would go through if you joined the Marine Corps. And his prison experience and doing the Islam thing was kind of like a Marine Corps sort of experience. And so I was able to identify with that. A great deal, and I'm able to identify a great deal with his early life. The feeling of being alienated, the feeling of finding the street life to be attractive. I was never a part of any kind of street life, but I found it when I was a young man to be attractive. I mean, it seemed an awfully, hustlers and people like that seemed awfully attractive people. All those aspects I found enormously appealing in the autobiography.
Did it give you confidence to be yourself or to allow yourself to change, much as Malcolm X had transformed himself?
Yes, it did, and it particularly through books. because the thing that struck me most about the conversion was that it was intellectual. I mean, he converted through books, and he listed a whole bunch of books in that chapter. And I remember going to the library to track down those books. I remember trying to find J. Roger Sex and Race and trying to find Herodotus and all that stuff, you know, and tracking down that stuff and wanting to read it. I think that was the biggest thing about it was that, because I was a kind of studious boy, I think no one had ever quite framed for me the possibility that intellect and reading could give you that kind of power as Malcolm did.
Yeah, well, reading and being an intellectual is usually considered pretty uncool when you're young.
Yeah, but he made it seem cool, you know. And also, you know, you have to remember that I was first introduced to Malcolm not even through this book, but through his speeches and having seen him on TV. And he made being learned and pursuing books very attractive to me. You know, after I read the autobiography, I said, well, you know, if you read books and then you wind up talking with the kind of authority, with the kind of moral authority and the kind of moral imperative in your voice that Malcolm has, then there really is something to be said about reading, and there really is something to be said about intellect, and there really is something to be said that it has some kind of effect or power to do something in this world that has kind of effect in this world, which... with something like Richard Wright, where he also talked about becoming an intellectual and black boy, it wasn't the same thing because it was all personal. I mean, it was all sort of personal. I want to be a writer and this sort of thing. It wasn't sort of, you know, from out of this, the world is going to really, you know, you can really make some kind of impact in the world through your mind. But it was Malcolm who really convinced me that you could make an impact in the world through your mind.
Did your friends share this with you? Did they read the book? Did they also have a sense that reading and speaking well could have this incredible power?
Not particularly, no. I mean, they weren't into this. You know, the years that we're talking about here, 65 and 66. And no, most of my friends really didn't connect up. In fact, they really didn't connect up with black power or any of those things. That didn't come until a few years later, like 68 and 69. It's very funny. I came from a black working class background, what Martin Kilson would call the tertiary elite, to use his rather learned term. And, you know, I mean, we're talking about people who were hospital orderlies, people who worked in meatpacking plants, construction laborers, people who worked in barbershops or owned barbershops, beauticians. And this was the class of black people I grew up with. And, you know, I mean, there were very few black people I knew when I was growing up who didn't work or who were on welfare. Most of them had working class kind of jobs. And they're people who tend to be cynical. And and in some ways, Malcolm spoke to them and to that class. And in other ways, they were very cynical of him and very cynical of Islam and very cynical of the Muslims and rather thought this was some kind of hustle and was rather thinking of Malcolm as in some way having some kind of hustle going, you know, that this was some kind of slick hustle or something like that to get some money out of the community. You know, they used to talk all the time about, you know, well, when you go to the Muslim temple, you know, or you go to one of their big rallies. All they do, ten times during the time they're having the rally, is pass these big white buckets around for you to throw money in. So, and all you ever see those guys doing on the corner, man. All they're doing is pushing Mohammed Speaks and bean pies and like that. So you know, people criticize them for that. So the very kinds of things, the very kind of industry that the Muslims showed. Was met, I think, with a kind of paradoxical eye. On the one hand, people did respect them because, you know, they did clean up their followers and they did show a lot of industry. But on the other hand, people saw it as a kind of hustle.
You've written that your attitude changed as you got older about Malcolm X and his rhetoric started to seem out of date. When did you start feeling that way and why?
There were dimensions of Malcolm X in the book. I mean, there were dimensions about Malcolm X that never came out in the book that to me seemed as though they ought to be addressed in some way. So I would say by the time I got to my middle 20s, the autobiography of Malcolm X was a book that I no longer trusted And the rhetoric associated with, you know, that kind of intense black consciousness was something that had become suspect for me, too. It became suspect for me because I was kind of thinking that it seemed to be another way of creating a sort of prison out of race, and this began to concern me. But one of the major thing that really began to concern me about Malcolm X was that after I read the book closely, it occurred to me that the whole business that really the book turns on in some way, when he goes to the second conversion, he finds this non-racialist Islam. It after having read the book closely, even before having read other kinds of sources which supported what I discovered, just from the autobiography itself, I discovered that was fake. I mean, that was absolutely fake. I mean, there was no kind of magical conversion like that that took place in Mecca that I suddenly discovered the non-racialist Islam. He knew about a non-racialist Islam for a very long time. It's just that for a long time, it was convenient for him to ignore the fact that Islam was not a race-based religion. And for a long time, the discovery of that bothered me, and I was unable to really deal with Malcolm for a long time because I was unable to appreciate the complexity of that discovery. It just at first made me just see him as being dishonest in the book as being just utterly suspect.
And now how do you see it?
In the last year or so, I've been able to go back to Malcolm with a renewed interest in the complexities of the man after having been away from the book for a while because it occurred to me that there's something awfully complex and awfully interesting about a man who I think was basically an honest man who wound up being caught in a situation where he was preaching something that he knew wasn't true, which I think a whole lot of people who preach some kind of religious line, in fact do.
My guest is Gerald Early, and he chairs the African and Afro-American Studies Department at Washington State University in St. Louis. And he's the editor of the forthcoming anthology Lure and Loathing, Essays on Race, Identity, and the Ambivalence of Assimilation. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gerald Early. You chair the African and Afro-American Studies Department at Washington State University in St. Louis. In your recent essay on Malcolm X, you wrote that Malcolm X is the ideological standard that's being offered up by your students who are accusing you of not being black enough to head the African and Afro-American Studies Department. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, Malcolm is, you know, Malcolm, you know, insofar as being somebody who, you know, said that black people are African and, you know, we ought to connect up as Africans and all that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, basically that somebody, that a lot of young people feel that anybody who runs an African Afro-American Studies program should have that same kind of ideological bent. You know, Malcolm was this model of blackness, you know. But the whole idea, you know, I think as I've talked about in the article and probably could have been developed more, that among black people, generational strife, and a part of this is just generational, the generational strife among black people is very serious business. And also that black generations, younger black generations, always tend to accuse older blacks of not being sufficiently black, that you kind of sold out. And all that sort of stuff, and that kind is always that kind of tension that that exists. But Malcolm was a very, I think Malcolm has become a very attractive figure. I mean, I use Malcolm there, you know, because I think that you know the kids kind of wanted somebody who was, you know, who'd be coming out of that sort of would be coming out of that sort of, not only that sort of ideological bag, but would be that kind of personality, someone who was going to stand up and tell the white folks, you know, someone who's going to stand up to the white administration and tell them you're racist dogs, and, you know, you need to do something about this program, and, you know, that sort of thing. You know, Malcolm, because he was very bold in his confrontation, that makes him a very romantic figure to young people, because he was so bold in telling white people bluntly what he thought and accusing them of racism and so forth. And that's just tremendously attractive, and to someone who speaks his mind like that, and most of us go around in life sort of, you know, mincing our words and all that sort of thing, and being very careful about, well, I don't want to say this to this person and all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, we always wind up seeming as though we're shuffling and compromising and everything.
So do you think that there are parts of Afrocentrism that have become identified in a way with anti-intellectualism?
Oh, sure, definitely. The interesting thing about that, of course, is that the Afrocentric movement is a movement that prides itself so much on being intellectual. But when ideology, you know, sort of rules the day, and you have difficulty in having a variety of points of view expressed, you're essentially talking about an anti-intellectual movement. There's been a great diversity of thinking among black people historically in this country. You know, that diversity must be respected, as a relative of mine always used to say, all roads lead to Rome and all roads must be taken. And, you know, that frame of mind, you know, that has to be respected. Afrocentrism essentially wants to create an ideological vision so that all black people can be united. In essence, Afrocentrism is an expression of the age-old desire among black people that we be united on the basis of something other than having shared a common oppression.
I guess you see this kind of dual aspect of racial community, that on the one hand, it gives this really strong sense of belonging and a strong sense of community and pride and ancestry, but on the other hand, it can be stifling. It can be a conforming influence.
Oh, sure. It can be stifling, it can be philistine, it can be a lot of things. It can be intensely anti-intellectual, as any kind of community. I mean, as any, you know, and, you know, I'm not...
Right, right.
Pointing out just, I mean, anything. I mean, the Catholic Church, I mean, anything can be like that once you get...
And any kind of, like, ethnic identity movement.
Right. Any sorts of movements, once they become, once they reach this certain kind of dogma level or orthodoxy level, they can become enormously stifling because they become frightened of any kind of dissent. But you can have intellect, and you can have intellectual movement, and you can have intellectual flowering without dissent. I mean, the whole essence of intellectualism is dissent. Afrocentrism has started out as a dissent movement in relation to white intellectualism, Eurocentrism, whatever you want to call it. But it's now placed itself as a kind of orthodoxy. And I think naturally it would produce a dissent of its own. It has to. In some ways, in order for it to even survive, it has to produce this kind of dissent of its own. But ethnic identification in that way can be extremely stifling and extremely dangerous.
I know you find it paradoxical that Malcolm X, one of the kind of creators of Afrocentric thought, has really told a uniquely American story, in the sense that the story of reinvention is the kind of quintessential American story.
Yeah, it is. And that is really, really interesting about Malcolm. But the whole business of, you know, reinventing himself, the whole business of conversion, the whole everything about, you know, this whole preoccupation, the way he's even preoccupied with his identity is very American. In many respects, it's just a particular subset of American, that is Black American, that comes out. But Americans are pretty pretty preoccupied, pretty self-absorbed with the whole quest of identity and that sort of thing. I mean, you know, those, you know, just the idea of a quest for identity to people in a lot of cultures, a lot of other cultures, is just odd or, you know, different, or, you know, they'll just say, well, that's American. Yes, he wrote a very American story, which is why, one of the reasons I believe the book has had the kind of popularity it's had, and one of the reasons why I think the movie will probably be very popular and successful and a lot of people will go see it, is that, you know, underneath it all, despite all the race talk and everything else, is that, you know, it's an American story.
If your students sometimes feel that you're, quote, not black enough to chair the department, does that ever cause you this kind of self-examine yourself and see, well, am I not? I mean, what does that mean? And should I change? And if I changed, how would I change?
Oh, sure. It does that all the time because I think there's always a certain amount of examining going on with any black person. I think especially when you're dealing with, if you're largely operating in a white world and you're largely thinking about your race consciousness, you're thinking about, you know, some kind of integrity that you have as a black person and so forth, that I think, yes, you're constantly thinking about, you're constantly thinking about that sort of thing. I think you think about you think about that as much as Puritans used to think about whether they were saved or not. Yes, you think about, have I sold out, or have I, you know, maybe I have some, you know, I think that, you, of course you do. And so I think that in some ways I've tried to meet the students even more so in an effort to show, you know, that I really do have their interest at heart, in an effort to show that I really am sympathetic to them and so forth, and sympathetic to their concerns and so forth. I've really tried to reach out to them in some ways because of that. And so, you know, those sorts of things, you know, that sort of thing does affect you. You know, because as a successful black person, you get to a point where your success has meaning only because you want to be able to show younger black people something, teach them something, that just makes your life have some kind of meaning, and you feel as though what you've achieved has significance in some way because you're able to guide or mentor some younger black people in your life as some kind of an example. So naturally, you're very upset and distraught and disturbed if that turns out to not be the case and you're being rejected in some way. But as I said, I think this is a kind of paradox in black life, and this is a kind of strife that occurs in black life because, you know, there's always been this tension of younger and older. You know, if you just look back at the civil rights movement and the black power movement that came out of it, the black power movement that came out of it was largely younger blacks saying to the older black civil rights establishment, we don't like the way you guys are doing. In fact, we think we think it's useless, and what you've achieved is useless, and we're going to go out here and we're going to do this thing the way it should be done. And, you know, that's just a very dramatic kind of broad cultural example of that kind of tension. And I'm sure it made the older black leaders angry. But I think even more than that, it probably hurt them. I mean, they probably felt very hurt by it.
Gerald Early chairs the African and African American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. He is the editor of the forthcoming anthology Lure and Loathing, Essays on Ethnicity and Race in America. His essay on Malcolm X is in the December issue of Harper's. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, X, the opera. We talk with Anthony Davis about his opera based on the life and times of Malcolm X. It premiered at the New York City Opera in 1986. Now it's been released on CD. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, will have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Little Rock, Arkansas, members of President-elect Bill Clinton's transition team have announced that Clinton will convene a conference of economists and business leaders next month. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Little Rock.
About 100 people will attend the conference to provide the president-elect with their assessment of the state of the U.S. economy. The attendees will be announced next week. They'll be chosen by transition board member Mickey Cantor from a list of thousands. Other than Clinton and Gore, no elected officials will be present. Ever since the meeting was first announced, Clinton's staff has struggled to define it. First, it was called a summit, but worried that title inflated expectations, it was downgraded to a retreat. Now it's being called a working conference or a presidential hearing. Its purpose is described as dialogue and input, not solutions to economic problems. As one Clinton aide described it, it's more for image building than policy development. It's meant to prove to the American people that Clinton meant what he said when he promised to focus like a laser beam on the economy. The working sessions of the conference will be televised. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
In New York City, the UN General Assembly has approved a new resolution criticizing recent attempts by the United States to expand its trade embargo against Cuba. The resolution calls on countries to resist the so-called Torricelli Bill, which was signed into law by President Bush late last month. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The Torricelli Bill bans foreign subsidiaries of American companies from doing business with Cuba. It also says that ships that have carried cargo to Cuba may not dock in the U.S. for 6 months. Many governments have complained that the bill is little more than an attempt by the U.S. to force its views on them and interfere in their trading practices. The resolution criticizing the bill was approved by a vote of 59-3 today. Those voting for the resolution included U.S. allies such as Canada and France. 71 countries abstained, but some of them made clear they dislike the Torricelli bill, too. Today's resolution is non-binding and will not affect the bill directly, but Cuban officials are hoping it will cause the incoming Clinton administration to think hard before deciding to enforce the bill. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
A winter storm that left more than a foot of snow in the Rockies has now moved into the Plain States. Wind and snow forced the closing of parts of Interstate 40 in Texas, and police say up to 200 cars were involved in an early morning accident on that same highway. Many schools were closed again today in parts of Colorado and Wyoming. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 25 points to close at 3,248.70 on volume of more than 242 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 10-7. This is NPR News. In New York City, the UN Security Council has turned aside Iraq's assertions it has complied with terms of a Persian Gulf War ceasefire amid some indications that economic sanctions against Baghdad will continue. Iraqi officials have accused Western diplomats of hypocrisy and insist that real progress has taken place. Iraq wants a gradual easing of economic sanctions against it in line with ceasefire compliance. But UN Security Council members contend that Iraq has not complied with the ceasefire that ended the Persian Gulf War, including full disclosure of its arms programs. Weeks after the UN imposed a no-fly zone over Bosnia, the U.S. and its allies are wrestling with what to do about apparent Serbian violations. More than 50 flights have been detected, and the State Department says some were by military planes and helicopters. Barry Schwide reports.
Only after long delay is the State Department saying there have been military planes and helicopters in the no-fly zone. There is still no judgment what kind of mission they were on, whether Bosnian Muslims were attacked, for instance, and beyond that, there's no rush to make a decision how to enforce the no-fly zone. The Bush administration is willing to have the UN take the lead in assessing the Serbian flights, and the UN has yet to describe the flights as in violation of the air cap placed over Bosnia to protect the besieged Muslims. Even if the Serbs are declared to be in violation, there is apt to be lengthy consultation and considerable uncertainty what to do about it. Neither the U.S. nor the Europeans appear to be eager for a showdown. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
According to the Conference Board, consumer confidence increased in November compared to the level of confidence felt in October. The private business research group says its consumer confidence index gained more than 10 points in November, as other economic reports also indicated improvement. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 8 years before Spike Lee's new movie, Anthony Davis composed an opera about Malcolm X. We'll talk with Davis in a few minutes. X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, was first performed in Philadelphia in 1985 and performed the following year by the New York City Opera. Now Gramavision has released the first recording of the opera. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review. Lloyd says that in the last few years, American composers seem to have learned from Mozart, Verdi, and Wagner that contemporary political issues make good subjects for opera.
These jazzy riffs don't sound very classical, but they're actually excerpts from an exciting contemporary opera, Anthony Davis's X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. Davis says his music fuses jazz, opera, pop, and African musical idioms. He also throws in minimalism, blues, and Broadway. One section is even in three-quarters time. This mixture of idioms has been a modern tradition since Stravinsky, Bartok, and Kurt Weill. Davis takes this impulse even further. But his fusion doesn't always quite fuse. X seems to me most successful at either its jazziest or its most lyrical. It's most conventional when it sounds like 12-tone modern opera, as when Malcolm's mother describes a visit by the KKK. The scenario, created by Davis's brother Christopher, follows the chronology of Malcolm's life from his childhood in Lansing, Michigan, to his assassination in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem in 1965 at the age of 39. We see scenes of his incarceration in Boston, his black separatist preaching, and his spiritual pilgrimage to Mecca. X strikes me as being mainly about internal transformation. The libretto by the Davis's cousin Thulani Davis tends to poetic abstraction, which softens Malcolm's political edge. The still center of the entire opera is the scene in Mecca.
Bismillah.
Eugene Perry, the wonderful baritone who sang Don Giovanni in the controversial Peter Sellers production telecast on PBS, brings Malcolm's inner conflicts powerfully to life. Malcolm's brother Reginald is sung by bass baritone Herbert Perry, Eugene Perry's real-life twin brother. There are two inspired strokes of casting: Malcolm's mother, who goes mad with grief when her husband is lynched, and Malcolm's wife are both sung by the same eloquent soprano, Priscilla Baskerville. And tenor Thomas Young is brilliantly convincing in two very different roles. He plays black Muslim spiritual leader Elijah Muhammad, who changes what he calls Malcolm's slave name, Malcolm Little, to Malcolm X. And he also plays a seductive hustler named Street, Davis's version of Gershwin's Sportin' Life, who first gets Malcolm into trouble with the law. This is Street's anthem. The chorus consists of all the singers in smaller but individual parts, who create a vital image of surrounding street life. Unlike Porgy and Bess, the greatest source of energy in X comes from the orchestration rather than the vocal line. In some ways, the real stars of the recording are the Orchestra of St. Luke's, conducted by William Henry Curry, and Anthony Davis's own amazing 14-piece ensemble, Episteme, with Davis himself on celesta. As jazz critic Francis Davis, not a relative, points out in his excellent liner notes, one of the most significant elements of the opera is the suggestion of improvisation in a carefully planned, highly formal score.
So much, I thought it was my name. Now the chickens they sent out are coming home to roost.
If X finally underplays the most radical elements of Malcolm's philosophy, still its engagement with real issues and its powerful, evocative score put it comfortably at the top of the list of contemporary political operas. It might even make a good movie.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Anthony Davis's X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, on the Gramavision label. We'll meet the composer of X after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us on the phone from Cambridge is Anthony Davis, the composer of the opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. Davis is also the composer of Tanya, an opera about Patty Hearst, and he leads his own jazz ensemble. This semester, he's teaching courses at Harvard on the history of jazz and on African-American composers. His cousin Talani Davis wrote the libretto for X. His brother Christopher wrote the book. Anthony Davis told me how he decided to write an opera about Malcolm X.
I guess it came about because I've been thinking for a long time about writing an opera, and I was inspired initially by Wagner and Strauss and Germanic composers, and I was looking for a subject, and I always thought Malcolm X is a hero to me, and a very complex hero, and I thought that in a way his story and the story of Malcolm X would be fantastic in terms of telling an opera. In a way, he's a heroic figure like a Ulysses or a Siegfried, who goes through all these transformations and, you know, signified by the changes in his name, etc. So I thought it would be a fantastic subject for an opera that would also embrace, you know, all the conflicts and contrasts that are in my music.
Malcolm X went through so many transformations, from hoodlum to prisoner to self-educated man, leader of the nation of Islam, black nationalist, spiritual person. What are some of the different types of music that you felt would go along with those transformations that he went through?
Well, I think when I first talked about doing the opera with my brother Christopher, he had in mind the idea of the music sort of having a parallel development to the, you know, the political and social developments going on. And so for example, in the 40s, I do sort of a takeoff on some of the big band dance music, you know, Lionel Hampton, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, et cetera, you know. And then I move more toward the bebop period, et cetera. And there's even in Zoot Suit song, there's a Fats Waller reference in that. And then later on in the music, I evoke John Coltrane, who also is an example of sort of American Islamic music, in the sense that he embraced Islam, and the Love Supreme, of course, was about Allah. And so I thought that it would be effective to look back at the music, some of the music of the 60s that I think was sort of the musical parallel to Malcolm. In this Malcolm X in the 60s, but the additional task of trying to create a unified structure that could embrace these idioms, you know, not necessarily having a succession of styles, but a unified musical statement.
You know, to some extent, it might seem odd to some people that you've used a European form, the opera, to tell the story of a man who helped create an African identity for African Americans. Do you see that as a contradiction at all?
No, I don't. I think that, but the idea to me was to make that European form an American and American one, and particularly an African American form. I mean, to take something that was European. I mean, as Coleman Hawkins took the saxophone, or Johnny Hodges took an alto saxophone, or Louis Armstrong took a trumpet. I mean, they were all European instruments, and I feel that the history of blacks in America is transforming and taking something that might have been European to begin with, and making it into something quite different.
What do you like about opera as a form?
Well, I love the idea of the merger of drama and music, and the idea of setting text to music. I mean, because I love words, and I think because my father was an English professor and love literature, that I always thought about telling some of the great stories. I think there's so many stories to tell, you know, in our culture, and I'm very excited about being able to realize that through music.
Your father, the late Charles Davis, chaired the Afro-American Studies Department at Yale, and he was also the first black faculty member at Princeton. So you were brought up in a family that had a strong consciousness. I wonder if you think that Malcolm X, in a way, had a different meaning for you as somebody who already kind of came from a household with a consciousness. Do you know what I'm saying?
That I came from a house. I think that
because, you know, a lot of people talk about how Malcolm taught them to have pride in being black and to have pride in being a black man. I would assume in your house that was something that you were kind of brought up with.
Well, yeah, I think that it's somewhat different in that way. I think also my family, I mean, basically had much more, and initially had much more bourgeois values too, in a certain way. But I think that, but for me, I went through a whole rebellion phase in which I was really rejected a lot of sort of the assimilationist aspect, you know, and I was really intrigued, for example, you know, with the Black Panthers and the Black Power movement, et cetera, later on. So, it was interesting to me. For me, it was a different kind of revelation of really realizing my blackness and how important that was.
What were some of the bourgeois values that you rejected when you went through the rebellion?
Well, I'm saying that rather facetiously, but also to say that, I became much more interested in who I was in relation to my defining myself as a black person.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. I mean, in a sense, growing up in a community in which my brother and I were only the only black kids in a school, you know, in State College, Pennsylvania, it was very difficult in a way. You know, I felt socially very apart from a lot of my peers. But for me, I think to realize this aspect of who I was and how important this was, and I think also it represented musically, because I was a classically trained musician in classical music, and I decided to really turn my back on classical music, and I just totally dove into jazz, into the whole jazz, and to learning about African American music, and that became my focus for forever, you know. So that was very important for me, because it was part of my self-definition.
My guest is composer Anthony Davis. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tonight we'll talk with Senator Dennis DeConcini. He's traveled to the countries that used to be Yugoslavia about recommending U.S. and European recognition of the Republic of Macedonia. Greece, of course, is resisting that. It's been even suggested that the democratic government of Greece could fall if the prime minister gave in on this issue. From London, a discussion of this question: who should pay for the fire damage to Windsor Castle, the royal family or the good people of Britain? Also, we'll talk with the brother-in-law of Mike Plant, the sailor who's missing in the Atlantic. His boat, the Coyote, has been found capsized. It's thought that he could be alive inside a watertight compartment.
Thanks. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Anthony Davis, the composer of the opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, which has just been released on CD. When you were writing the opera X, did different parts of Malcolm's life come into focus in a new way for you? Did you start finding things in his life that you hadn't noticed before, or identifying with different aspects of his life than you had before?
Oh, I think so. I think that happened all the time. I think one thing was identifying particularly with the breakup with Elijah Muhammad. I mean, what it must have felt like emotionally, you know, for a man like Malcolm to be silenced by someone, you know, and how he would actually kind of go with that idea for a period. I mean, that would be the worst thing to me. I mean, to get to that hollow place when Malcolm feels really that, you know, here is this father figure who really betrayed him, and to feel that sense of betrayal and that sense of loneliness, really. You know, and then to rebuild himself, and as we did in the opera, redeemed him with the pilgrimage to Mecca, and so that to me was it was a very emotional thing, and to me it's a kind of moments that I think anyone can identify with, you know, and then also his, you know, all those moments of transformation when you know he this really angry young man who's full of rage that ends the first act, and then in the second act, you know, he's just slowly seduced into the Nation of Islam. And it's really seduction. You have Elijah Muhammad saying, "You are not empty, nor are you lost, you're Malcolm, cold and just, no fear of loss." And it's kind of the melodies I was creating with it. The idea of this kind of interplay, this seduction that would go on, that was very important, because I think what you get at in music that's so interesting is the emotion. It's not about portraying reality in the sense of something that happens in real time. It's the inner feeling, the inner what goes on inside a person, and not only the emotions themselves, but the ideas behind the emotions.
When you were writing the opera, did you play Malcolm X's speeches a lot in the background just to get into the rhythms of his voice?
Well, I did listen to speeches. I didn't play it constantly. I mean, I'd listen to speeches. But I sort of came with a metaphor for it. I mean, I would think of, we always talk about, what's Malcolm's voice like? What's the musical equivalent to Malcolm in terms of the way he would discourse and the wit, the humor, et cetera. And I began to think of, and also the rhythm of his language, the use of repetition, the short phrases, et cetera. And I began to think of how Miles Davis plays the trumpet, So I was very interested in that, So there are moments when I'm setting his words to music that I said, the background, et cetera, has that kind of feeling because I'm thinking about a lot of that kind of staccato, rhythmic, really active rhythmic playing.
Is there a section you have in mind that you're thinking of?
Oh, I think it's when the section in one of the speeches, when I was little, they called me nigger so much, I thought it was my... I mean, in the background is this kind of really funk groove, that's in a kind of odd meter. So it has this metric pattern underneath it. But also that... I would like the idea of these short little phrases, these little germs of phrases in there.
So you haven't seen the movie Malcolm X yet, have you?
Oh.
Are you looking forward to seeing it?
Oh, yes, very much. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to see it. I want to see it. I'm going to go with my son to see it later this week.
Oh, that's interesting. Anthony Davis, thanks a lot for talking with us.
All right, well, thank you.
Anthony Davis is the composer of X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. A recording of this opera has just been released by Gramavision. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Harris Wofford, the senator from Pennsylvania. His campaign was handled by James Carville. It focused on health insurance reform, and it helped set the tone for the Clinton campaign. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.